This is file 106. Today's date is September 8th, 2015. I am on Mount Riga. I am interviewing Frances Sortel Miller at her home, Wentworth, and she's going to give her family background, and then she's going to tell me all sorts of wonderful things about Mount Riga, the mountain, the house, and her winter on the mountain, as well as a few ghost stories about Grandma Thurston. But we'll start with the genealogical information. What is your name?
Frances Sortel Miller.
And your birth date?
March 22nd, 1939.
And your birthplace?
Bronxville, New York.
Your parents' names, please.
My father's name was Charles Worthington Sortel, and my mother's name was Edna Stiles Sortel.
Was she a local Stiles from Salisbury?
From Connecticut.
From Connecticut, okay. Siblings?
I have two brothers. I have an older brother by 2 years, born in 1937, Robert Monroe Sortel, and a twin brother, Chester Worthington Sortel.
All right. What is your educational background after high school?
I attended Marietta College, majoring in the sciences, a BA in biology, and went on to graduate school at Duke University School of Medicine for a physical therapy degree, or certificate.
Okay. And I'm going to ask you about your connection to the mountain. How did your people actually come here to the mountain?
My father attended Union College and was a roommate with Lambert Borden, local. He had the lease from the Mount Riga Corporation at the time. And my father would come up and visit with the Bordens and spend holidays and whatnot up here. And when the war came, and my mother and father had us kids going to camp over in Camp Sloan in Lakeville, Connecticut, and they went over to visit Mrs. Borden, who is now Mrs. Scott, because Mr. Borden had died.
Was this the Borden of Borden Milk?
This is the Borden of Borden Milk, yes. And my father asked Mrs. Scott just how were things up on the mountain and how was the house, the Wentworth Cottage, and she said it's fine, but none of her children were really interested in living there or using it, and wonderfully asked if Dad would like to sublease it from her. So Mom and Dad did sublease it, and that's
what year?
1948, as near as I can recollect. It was after the war. It might have been 47, but maybe it was 47 when we were in Camp Sloan, and then we started coming up here as children in 48. And then my father, as an officer in the reserves, was called back into the Korean action, the Korean War. And we were away for 2 years touring with Dad. I would have been a young teenager at that point. And after that skirmish, we returned to White Plains, New York, where we still had our same house and all, and started coming up to the mountain on a regular basis. And Mom would stay up here with the three of us kids, and Dad would come up on weekends. And so it was just a little piece of heaven that we kids grew up in and just loved it ever since.
How much property, approximately?
I think it's 2 acres. It just goes from the road, the main road going up, coming up the mountain over to a stone wall that's further back in the bushes, if you will.
And
from the lake up to, at least to the water tower.
I now know what the water tower is. Do you know how Wentworth got its name?
Well, I believe that the last family that lived here during the iron industry were the Wentworths. And when all the people who worked in the iron industry went down off or their taxes were paid by the members of the Mount Riga Corporation or whatever, that this place was then left to the corporation.
And it was built, according to the sign outside, in what year?
To the best of our knowledge, it was 1758. And it was originally a store. And it's purported to have sold the first silk dress in the United States. How true that is anybody's guess.
Okay, all right.
But it was a store during the, what I call it, I call it the original town of Salisbury as being up here. Because there was a schoolhouse, and there were people living up here, many of them who worked with the iron industry, either as the charcoal, the colliers who worked the charcoal thing, or the limestone people, or any of the miners that had to do with the furnace.
But they never had a church up here.
I don't believe they ever had a church up here.
In the original schoolhouse, the big one, they used to use in the summertime, they used to use it for Sunday afternoon. Somebody would come up from down in the valley and preach to get a little religious instruction.
Yeah.
Now, your parents actually leased the property about 1952?
Yes, by that time we were leasing directly from the corporation.
And was it leasing the building? Or the building and the land?
The buildings and the land as far as leasing goes. And it was about sometime in 1952 or 1953 that the Mount Riga Corporation asked my parents if they would be willing to buy the buildings as they were,
mm-hmm.
But they weren't able to buy the land. They were keeping all the land in their own.
So it's a leasehold.
It's a leasehold. And yes, I don't know what a leasehold is.
Well, leasehold is it's an English term, and it means the building, not the land.
Okay.
So we're right on that one.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
Tell me about the buildings on this property. You've got some interesting names for them, too.
Yes. Certainly the main camp is the Wentworth Cottage. And then there were two other buildings. We call them the Filipino cabins, the brown cabin and the guest cabin. And between those two, there was a porch between them, and they were connected on the lake side of the property. Then beyond that, there's another cabin. There were two cabins that were joined by a porch, and only one of those exists. We had to take it down because one was rotting. And then we had the what we call the water tower, which is a tower that was fully enclosed.
Thank you.
Metal in shape.
Thank you.
And there was a water tank up on top. And the interesting thing about that is that we would pump water from the lake with a Fairbanks Morse,
engine and pump.
Single cylinder. That would pump water. It had a flywheel. It was unbelievably heavy, but my father was able to spin that every 4 or 5 days, and he'd pump water up to the top of the tower and up into the tank, and it was one of us children's duty to go up and measure just how much water was in the tank. So that was meant scaling the side of the water tower to stick a large stick.
Like a dipstick.
Exactly. To measure the water to see if we needed to pump, and also to be sure how full it was, although that overflowed too. So.
Now, you said something about the Filipino
cabins.
Why were they called Filipino cabins?
Well, it was my understanding that the Bordens at one time went to the Philippines and were enamored with the structure of the cabins that they had there in the Philippines, and came home and built them here on the mountain. They're a wonderful cabin because they have large eaves, and underneath the eaves there is open screening to allow the breezes to come in, but not the rain.
Which is something that would be done in a tropical environment rather than this kind of an environment, which isn't necessarily tropical except for today.
And we're not here in the wintertime.
All right. Now, while you were here in the summertime, How did you cook? What kind of facilities did you have for cooking? Was it a wood stove or a gas stove or propane or what?
Well, when we initially came up, there was a wood stove in Wentworth in the kitchen. And very shortly after that, and I can't remember the time, there was a gas stove put in and use of propane gas. But Mom still preferred cooking on the wood stove. And
more even heat.
And for heat, mm-hmm. certainly in the spring and the fall. And Mom was a great cook. And she managed that wood stove like a pro.
How about lighting?
Lighting was by kerosene lights primarily. However, we did have two propane lamps in the kitchen for additional lighting.
We put those in. Your mother didn't have those.
You put in the propane?
We put the propane in for the illumination. Lighting.
Okay, then it was just kerosene lights
just kerosene
as I was growing up.
And that's when you could get decent kerosene, which
you cannot
do today.
Now, you've told me about the water tank and pumping it from the lake up to the tank. Then how did you get it to the cabin? Did you have lines or did you have to, pump it with pails and bring it in?
No, it was a gravity flow system, and we had running pipes into the kitchen and into our bathroom, which was wonderful because this camp was blessed with a flush toilet.
Tell me about the flush toilet.
As I was growing up, eight or nine years old, right from the get-go, it was nice to have a flush toilet in the house. There was also a bathtub, and I do remember having had a bath or two in the tub.
Which was a clawfoot.
Which was a clawfoot bathtub, right. And, so we had running water. Always had running water in the spring and in the fall when we had to shut the water system down. We would then carry pails of water.
But it would be running cold water. You didn't have hot and cold running water.
No, we didn't.
It was always cold water. How did your mother heat water on the
stove?
We
had two large kettles.
Kettles.
Yep. We would fill those and boil the water and do the dishes.
Do whatever you had to do with it.
Yep.
Okay. Dr. Clark.
Oh, Dr. Clark.
Tell me about Dr. Clark and your foot. This is an interesting and a little gory story.
Well, it was after the war, and Dad had brought back pup tents for myself and my two brothers. And we wanted to put them up and sleep in them overnight out in the yard. So we all did that, but I wanted mine to be one I could sit up in. And so I was making sides for my pump tent, which was just, I don't know how you describe it, but 2x2 mm-hmm. forks and with a bar across it, and then the sides were by sticks, trees, and stuff that I would cut down. And I was splitting the tree parts at this point in time, and the axe bounced off the wood block and landed on my foot.
She was barefooted.
Yes. Of course she was barefooted.
So I looked at it when it happened, and I walked into where my mother was sitting at breakfast with my two brothers. And they were gawking. And Mother said, "For goodness sake, stop gawking and go get something to bandage your foot." So the two brothers scattered and got stuff to bandage my foot. And then Mom wrapped it up nice and tight. Or tightly, and took me up to Doc Clark. He lived in another. He was a New York physician, who had a. He was retired, and he was staying up at the Clark Camp, one of the camps on the lake. Now,
Upper Lake or Lower Lake?
Lower Lake, and owned by his sons, or indirectly wife, son, daughter, and so on. The Bartletts at the Bartlett Camp, and. He took a good look at it, opened it up, and one of the remembrances I had, because Mom was so concerned, here I was sitting in the car, and I got to Dr. Clark's, and I said to Mom, "Mom, I don't want to cry, but I have to." And with that, I dissolved into tears.
Of
but
course.
But not because of pain in my foot. But Dr. Clark was very gentle and very comforting. And he took a look at it and said, I somehow had missed the nerves and somehow had missed the bones. And yes, it's bleeding like crazy, but that's all the damage there is. And so...
You were so fortunate.
I was very fortunate. So he poured some alcohol on it. And that maybe started some more crying. I'm not sure, but that was pretty painful.
It
and
would be.
Then I had to go up every day, and he had to open this gaping wound, which was about 2 inches, extending out into one of the toes.
Yep.
And he would have to open it up, pour in more alcohol, bandage it up tightly. And, of course, I was out of swimming for a number of weeks, almost the whole two months of the summertime. But there weren't too many alternatives when you're living on the mountain.
No.
You go see Doc Clark.
Yes.
And thank goodness for him being here.
Oh, yes. And he knew what to do, and he was good about it.
Yep.
I'm going to go back just a bit to Wentworth and tell me about the loom room and a couple of stories about Grandma Thurston's ghost, please.
Okay. Wentworth does have a ghost. She's called Grandma Thurston. And the story, as it came down to me, was that Grandma Thurston actually lived in a house just above ours. There's a cellar hole where she lived. And when that house burned down or was destroyed, Grandma Thurston came and lived in the Wentworth house. And as near as I can tell, she ran the loom, hence it was called the loom room. And at some point in time, after she passed on, there were stories of her ghost being present. And one of the stories I remember most of all, there were some ghost hunters that had come up to the mountain, knowing, having heard, that our place had a ghost.
Those were the Warrens.
The Warrens. Thank you. That's the name. That's my husband talking in the background.
It wasn't the ghost of Grandma Thurston.
It wasn't the ghost of Grandma Thurston.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't have done that.
That's okay.
That's Peter Miller. But the Warrens were ghost hunters, and they had come up unbeknownst to Mom and Dad or without invitation, but when they explained who they were, Mom and Dad invited them in, and they were sitting around having drinks and cocktails, which is par for the course around here, and got talking. And they came out, Mr. Warren and my father came out to the kitchen to refresh the beverages, and Mr. Warren was carrying the tray of goodies back into the living room from the kitchen when the loom room door just opened completely and unbeknownst to anybody. And he just dropped the tray of glasses, broken glass everywhere, and spilled, grabbed his wife, and they didn't want to be in our house any longer. And they left.
That's wonderful.
That's the end of that story.
Are there more?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, there are more. I know that when Pete's sister was here, she had a pup, a dog. And whenever she's here, at about 2 or 2:30 in the morning, the dog gets very anxious and upset, scratches at the floor, and obviously it could be that he wants to go out, but he doesn't have this behavior at any other time. And it's just interesting that from one year to the next, it was always about 2:30 in the morning. And so what prompted that? I mean, yes, maybe one time there was a raccoon or something under the porch, who knows? But this dog did it every time.
And you're attributing that to Grandma Thurston?
Absolutely.
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 If you've got a ghost, you might as well use her.
Right.
Absolutely. I'm going to ask
I have another story.
Oh, you've got another? Oh, good.
This is a very weird story. Our daughter, Catherine, invited a couple of folks up for a weekend.
Oh, and she was in college.
When she was in college, she went to the University of Connecticut. And the two gentlemen were staying here in the main house upstairs. And when one of them, sort of in that state of waking and sleeping in the morning, felt a presence, felt the presence on him.
Ooh.
And felt this presence of whatever it was going inside him. And he was scared to death. And he left. When we found him in the morning, he was sitting outside and white as a sheet. And we asked him what was wrong. And he told us this story. And he said, I'm never going back in your house again. So, for whatever that's worth, that was, sounded like quite a ghost story. It must have been Grandma Thurston. She may not have liked him. Who knows?
Could be.
Or maybe loved him. Maybe that
helped it.
It was a Memorial Day weekend.
Yeah, it was a Memorial Day weekend. And we always go up routinely on Memorial Day to the seven-gun salute up at the graveyard because that's a Revolutionary War.
Tell me about that, please.
Well, there are a number of people up there who were in the Civil War, mm-hmm. and the Revolutionary War, mm-hmm. and other wars, all the wars.
Yep.
There have been people up there. And the people in town, in Salisbury, have Danny Brzee and his group of, mm-hmm. of six
veterans.
Veterans.
Yep.
Going up and firing off a seven-gun salute. And this is routine, and happens every Memorial Day, and my family have always tried to go up. My father,
oh, sure.
having been in the service, mm-hmm. Respect that.
And it's very
highly.
Appropriate to do that.
Mm-hmm. So we found, didn't we find not Justin, but whoever this fellow was. He was still white. He
yeah.
came up with us, but
he was still shaken by his...
Very shaken.
Very shaken.
Yeah. This is almost too real as far as he was concerned.
And totally unexpected.
Right.
We had talked
about Grandma Thurston being
yeah.
here as a resident ghost, and everybody goes, right.
Uh-huh.
And
uh-huh.
she's a friendly ghost. I mean, our approach is that she's friendly.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
Not going to hurt anybody.
No, she's not belligerent.
Belligerent.
Belligerent. There we go.
I can't spell belligerent. Nasty is fine. Oh, dear.
Yeah, when we open the door every spring, we always say, hi, Grandma, we're back. It's just sort of the family thing.
But that's all part of it.
That's all part of it.
Oh, sure.
Sure.
I'm going to ask a little bit about sports. And I want to ask about baseball first.
All right. Baseball, again, this is a childhood memory. There was always a softball game going on the mountain in August. I believe it was, and it was between the Mountain Lions and the Lilies of the Valley. And how this all got established, I do not know, but it was something that everybody attended, and of course we hooted and hollered for the Mountain Lions.
And the Lilies of the Valley would be the people from Salisbury down in the valley.
That's correct.
That would come up.
Yeah.
Were these men or boys or...
For me, at the age I was, they were all male.
They were all, okay, all right.
And their ages, I couldn't tell you. I mean,
okay.
Maybe they were late teens, 20s,
30s. That's what I was figuring, adolescent.
Mm.
Okay.
But I think mostly men, actually. I mean,
oh, they would be.
Jim Dresser's father played. I think my father played.
Yeah.
So
it would be the males. Did you play tennis?
Yes, I was a tennis player. I never won the trophy.
Is there a tradition that goes with the tournament?
Are you talking about if there's a winner, do they get something special?
No, I was given to understand from Sarah Warner Phillips that the tradition was whoever was officiating at the last tournament wore a funny hat.
Well, that's true. And that gentleman is James Dresser, Jimmy Dresser.
Okay.
And every year he has a different hat on.
Okay.
And he's been doing it for the last 25 years, minimum. In fact, this year he used a hat that he had worn once before, which was a great big tennis ball, probably about 18 inches in diameter, that you could let the air out some, and then he would cap it on his head. And he got that from... Fran Sautel Miller. I had bought that for him one year because I thought it would be a perfect tennis hat.
Oh, you are a clever lady. All right, now we're leading up to what I think is one of the most incredible experiences. You and your beloved husband
and 1999 to 2000 spent the winter up here.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that's what we're going to talk about. Tell me about your preparation.
All right. Well, the most important part of the preparation was to get my better half to agree to this crazy idea. But as a child, I always hated leaving the mountain, going off to school at the end of August. And I just vowed that someday I was going to spend a whole year up here where I don't have to go down off. So that I had carried on with my life and became a physical therapist and owned my own business and all of that, and suddenly all of that sort of came to an end thanks to age, and had time to think about the real important things in life. And it came to me one night, you wanted to spend a year on the mountain. And I laughed at that and I said, yes. So within a day or two, as I mulled over, I went to my husband and I said, "Hun, what do you think the possibilities would be for our staying a whole year on the mountain?" Meaning Mount Riga, of course. And he said, "Is there any other?" No. And he said, no, he didn't see how that could be done. So I let it drop at that. I planted the seed, and that's all my intention was initially. About 6 months later, Pete came to me and said, "Hun, do you remember that thought you had about staying the winter on the mountain?" I said, "Yes, indeed." And he said, "Well, I think we can do it." And I said, "Really?" And from there, it was all
uphill.
Preparation and uphill for that wonderful, wonderful adventure.
Now, tell me specifically about wood.
We would certainly need to be heating by fire, wood stoves. We had two of them. We had a yodel in the water tower, which is where we were going to stay. That was double insulated.
A yodel?
Yeah, J-O-T-U-L, it's a Norwegian or Swiss box, and it kept the fire going longer than the standard wood stove does. And we got another one for what we call the ice house, which was a connected building, and it was double-walled. And it used to be filled with sawdust during the, I don't know, whenever they stored wood from the lake, stored ice from the lake. It was double-walled construction with the sawdust. But for our plan, for wood, we calculated that we would need about 7 cord of wood. And Pete and I decided that we could gather that ourselves, and we combed the mountain for standing dead trees, which we cut into 7-foot lengths, which fit, 4-foot lengths? 4-foot lengths.
Yeah, I was going to say 7 foot's a little hard to handle.
Yeah, 4-foot lengths that we put in the back of the pickup truck, and we would bring loads and loads of those back, and then Pete would put them up on the sawhorses, and I would take the chainsaw, and we'd cut them into, 8-foot, 12-foot lengths?
16-inch and 18-inch, depending on which stove.
16-inch and 18-inch wood, and then those that we needed to split, we split, or the two children would split.
But you had a wood splitter. You weren't using them all.
Well, I was going to get to that. We didn't get that until end of September, October. Yes, we used them all in the beginning when we were splitting, and when Rob, our son, was wood splitting. Yeah, it was maul and axe. And fortunately, and many, many thanks to Jim Dresser, he asked if we would like his wood splitter, to borrow his wood splitter. And so that made the job a lot happier. And but still, it was Pete and I that did all the gathering and all the splitting.
That's a lot of wood.
98% of it.
That's a lot of wood.
Yeah, and all the axe work that needed to be done. So that they say that when you heat with wood, that you're heating yourself twice.
It warms you twice. It
warms you twice, and that's the biggest farce I ever heard. Because we were handling this wood
Well, you split it, you stack it, you put it in a fireplace.
And you stack, you're right. Yeah. And it just, so you get heated about four times over.
Yeah, I've done enough of that myself. All right, so, where did you store the wood?
We stored the wood. We had in the ice house of the buildings, we made a door and covered it with a refrigerator door, which would be insulated, and put in a sort of a little wood shed off of that to store the wood. Number one, it was insulated, so we wouldn't lose a lot of heat during the winter, and we had easy access right off the living room.
Plus the fact that wood shed that hung off the building had access from the outside. So you could go to your stockpile piles of wood and take armloads and keep that filled. So when the weather was really bad, you did not have to go outside to get wood for the fire or for the stoves.
That's really planning ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank
yep.
you. Yeah, that was...
It was.
But anything that would last 6 months, perhaps... would take a tremendous amount of planning because I forgot whatever, and you couldn't run to the store to get it. So
yes.
You really had to do a lot of planning and thinking. I'm a list person. Did you make lists and cross-check or just sort of...
Not really. I don't think we really had lists. We knew we had to have wood. We knew we had to have food. We knew we had to be able to get water. And so each of those
were their own
projects were their own things. So as long as... And what we did for water, this is also very interesting. We got a plastic garbage can, a new one, 33-gallon?
33-gallon
water thing, which we put on the second story of the wood house, of the water tower. And... drained it. What's the word?
We put a pipe outlet on the bottom of the tank and run a line across to the sink. So
sure.
When you wanted to wash your hands, you had running water. You didn't have to dip out of a
bucket
big
or something.
Container.
Right.
Yeah.
And this was just a perfect solution for our having water in the water tower. To use, and because we would have to heat water for coffee, we'd have to heat water to wash our hands, even to bathe in the middle of the winter, when you couldn't go jump in the lake, as it were.
Well, you could, but it would bounce.
There you go.
Got that right.
And to have that plumbed, that's the word I want, that line plumbed was just a wonderful, wonderful invention. But we still had to go, and we had to keep that 33-gallon tank filled. So we would, every day, have to go down to the lake and go to where we had an opening cut in the ice and get our two pails of water that we would have to bring up to the water tower and up the stairs and dump into the garbage.
What were the size of the pails? Were they 5-gallon pails or three or just regular pails?
About three, I think.
3 gallons. And you had
a yoke. We had a yoke that we got from Alice Combs. Loan borrowed from her, and that went across our shoulders, and it was great almost year round. But when the snow came, we needed to have our snowshoes, and our daughter had given us a pair of snowshoes that she used in Alaska. And
are those the snowshoes that are on the wall?
No, okay.
No,
these were plastic form fitted form things, but just we had to stay on top of the snow because you're carrying.
Yeah.
2 buckets of water,
sure.
And that was forcing you into the snow, so we had to use our snowshoes to get the water.
Tell about the hole in the lake.
The hole in the lake is also nice. Very interesting. We thought of many different ways of how to do this, and one of the ways was to have a ball, one of those hoppy jump balls that has a handle on it, and keep that into a keep the ice open, it would bounce up and down as the winds came, and that would keep the ice hole open. Well, that was plan one that failed miserably as soon as there were 2 days of freezing weather. So our next plan, fallback plan, was Pete put together a frame with black tar paper on it, and I'd say it was 5 by 12.
Two by four.
It wasn't 5 feet anyway.
It wasn't 12 feet.
It was 2 by 5 feet. I know it was longer. Anyway, that black tar paper was put over the hole to keep the ice from freezing. It would absorb some sun rays, black absorbing the sun, to keep it open for us. But in the middle of winter, and it being as cold as it was, every time we went down there, we had to open it further. It froze over.
Sure.
And we had to then keep that open.
But the freezing over was only...
Then, it was shell ice rather than...
That was on either side of an 18-inch deep ice hole.
And, and then the snow would blow down the lake and fill up the hole, so we would have to dig that hole out every day, or every time we went down every day, and chop out the ice hole and get our buckets in there and continue. It was really an amazing thing.
Oh, yes.
And then for drinking water, we did have the artesian well that's down at the crossroads on Mount Riga, just down the road. But we'd have to walk in the snow to get down there, too.
How about food?
Food is interesting, and it's funny that I don't remember more about that. One of our sad experiences, we had heard that keeping carrots and potatoes and the like in a large garbage can filled with sand. So we got a large aluminum can, and we kept that over in the main house. For sure it wouldn't really freeze solid over there. And they had more room. We did not have room at the water tower. So we could come over here to get our...
You were living in the water tower.
We were living in the water tower for this winter sojourn.
Was there a reason? Because it was...
It's insulated.
It's insulated, and it's small, so that you didn't have to heat a great, huge space.
Right. Exactly. And we went over there. I mean, date-wise, we went over there on October 16th. It had gotten so cold here in the main house, and we couldn't keep it warm any longer just with a little fireplace that we had there. But this potato and carrot thing, we were sure that was going to be a great way to have those vegetables. But as it turned out, those froze in the sand, and it was the smelliest, most god-awful smell I think either one of us had ever smelled. But now we had the sand we put in as we layered the carrots and the potatoes. Well, before you know it, you had a whole garbage can full of sand. And it's frozen.
Yes.
And come spring, to get it out of the house was unbelievable. Plus, it stunk. So, anyway, that's the story about that food. We did have a case of, like, tomato soup cans. We had bought a case of green beans or some such. Mm-hmm. I think we might have had chicken noodle soup, too. And then in the refrigerator, and we did have refrigeration, and a good thing, or it would have frozen if we had it outside, but we put it in the freezer of the refrigerator, the chops and hamburgers and chicken, and we had, and so we could just pull out what we wanted. We had plenty of spaghetti. We had jars of spaghetti sauce, or might have made my own. Do you remember more about our food?
I don't remember that.
I don't either.
Kind of one of those daily occurrences that is so automatic it gets slipped in the back of the mind and you just can't bring it forward.
But we always had enough food.
Oh, yes.
We didn't go hungry.
What about bread?
Bread? We tried making that, too, didn't we? A couple of times we made some bread.
Maybe. I don't remember that, either.
Might have kept that in the freezer, too.
Yeah. I know the kids made bread when they were growing up, but...
Did you have anything that was perishable?
Well,
you know, like, other than the carrots and the potatoes and the sand, I mean, did you get eggs? Did you have anything like that?
We did, but those, until January, and after, we were still able to go up and down the mountain road. There was not that much snow. It was a moderate winter, and we would, we kept our cars down at the bottom of the hill at Danny Brzee's, and then we had an all-terrain vehicle for our transportation that we could go up and down the mountain. And so we could go every 10 days or so to get needed supplies. And also we would take our garbage down using the ATV down to Pete's pickup truck and throw the barrels in there and head over to the dump.
So you weren't actually snowbound until January.
That's correct.
You told me about www.com.
Right. That was the because it was there was so much attention being put to the computers and to the Y2K problem, I sort of came up with just a slogan for myself and Pete that would be www.com, which stood for water every day. We had to put wood in every day. We had to walk every day for the exercise. And dot, most importantly, communicate. And we sort of lived by that slogan throughout the winter, either consciously or unconsciously. That was just how the winter had to go.
And how did you communicate?
We talked. I don't think Pete ever asked me to get your turn to go do the fire. I never told him at 4 o'clock in the morning, you've got to go put wood on the fire. We each knew
what you had to do,
what needed to be done, and we just did it.
Yeah.
We had no, there were never any
qualms.
How about communicating with the outside world, i.e. your children? How did you do that?
Or didn't you? Very seldom. But we did have what is called, known as the forerunner, well, the forerunner of the cell phone was called a bag phone. And it had to be charged. It was run by battery. I don't know how the heck we charged it. And we didn't use it for anything, but the kids, if they wanted to get in touch with us, could call on Sunday night between 7 and 8 p.m. our time, and we would stand by. And maybe that happened twice. And other communication was they wanted to come and be with us for Christmas, and that was great. So I said, wonderful, you can come and be with us for Christmas, but because we don't know of any of the weather conditions, you are on your own to get here and to get back to Bradley Airport or wherever. Our daughter was coming in from Oregon, and our son was coming in from New Mexico. And so that was their problem, but they came for Christmas, and it was just one of the best Christmases. We used dried orange slices and lemon slices and lime slices, and that's a whole other story. And then we used popcorn and cranberry that we threaded on ropes. Yeah, on thread.
Yeah.
And I had that decorating it. I don't know, it's just a very... And all our Christmas presents had to be handmade, whether they were jars or a knitted object or... I mean, jars of jam or jelly.
Yeah.
Or something knitted, or Pete made things out of wood. It was just fun. We hung our stockings on the stairs that went to the loft, and there was a stocking for everybody, and Santa Claus found us, and it was...
Oh, yes. Even if there wasn't a chimney to come down.
Even if there wasn't a chimney. And so that was just a wonderful experience. And the weather was good. We could go hiking and stuff and be outdoors most of the time.
We only had one scary incident.
Oh, tell about the scary incident.
Well, we were heating with wood, and we had single-wall stovepipes.
Uh-oh.
And, of course, when the smoke hit the stovepipe, which was outside, the creosote would collect on the inside of the pipe. And I went out with someone said you burn a hot fire, and it's supposed to take care of all the creosote.
Well, you throw some chemical in there, and it'll take all the creosote.
So we threw the stuff in, and the fire roared away, and I went outside. And it's the one over here on the tower. There was a creosote dripping off the stovepipe with flames landing on dried...
Shingles.
Shingles, wood shingles.
Nifty.
Nifty, you got that right. I ran inside, got a fire extinguisher, and put it out. But then we had to put in, double-walled smokestack, and that took a little bit of doing. In fact... That happened on Thanksgiving time. And my sister was staying over after the holiday. And she and I, in the rain, were putting up one stovepipe.
Oh, you have a good sister.
Yeah, she's a peach, yeah.
Oh, my.
Well, didn't that happen right after I was at Sharon Hospital?
I don't think so.
That was
before. It was early in the heating season. And then when I went up to put up one stovepipe, the drip edge on the roof, the flat roof, wouldn't let the stovepipe go up straight.
Ooh.
So I got a Mexican speed wrench, which is known as a hammer.
Yes, I
beat that thing and the stovepipe went straight. It's been like that ever since.
Ah, my word.
The other interesting part about that was before we got the, how much time do we have?
As much as you need.
I can keep talking forever. Because one of the things that Pete was working part-time, we were both retired, but he was working with an organ company, tuning organs in churches, and as you come into Thanksgiving and Christmas, that's the time to tune organs. So that I found myself up here most of the time from September through early December by myself during the week. And Pete would come up on the week, during the weekends. And I would have the fire going, because it would be pretty darn cold.
Mm-hmm.
And the creosote was burning on top of the stove as it dripped down. This is not knowing that it was on, some was on the outside. That The outside was when we threw in the chemical to burn away the, all that creosote. And as a result, I had been
breathing in.
I was just, couldn't keep a fire going without breathing the creosote. And that was really pretty miserable. And so that's sort of what prompted us to throw in this wonderful chemical to clean out all the creosote that hence almost burned the place down.
Oh, clever. Clever.
Breathing was difficult.
Yeah.
So.
That was an incredible experience. And I did meet your son, and I asked him, because you set me up on this one, what he thought of it, and he thought it was a wonderful idea and was so proud of the fact that you actually pulled it off. And he hopes to do it too.
Yeah.
Which I think is great.
And I think our daughter does as well.
Ah, good.
She's as tough as we are. Both
well,
tough
you,
as nails.
You are an incredible couple. Before I close this, is there anything that either one of you would like to add to this interview that I haven't covered or that you wish to add?
I don't think so. The sights and sounds that we saw, you would never see unless you were here.
You told me about your black squirrels.
Yes, we had one or two black squirrels. We'd only see one at a time. Cute as little buttons, and they would play in and out of the, there must have been two, in and out of the wood piles that we had on the porch. And Pete and I got, so we put little peanuts out for them and hid them in the wood piles, and we could watch the squirrels find them and eat them up on the thing through the large window. There's another incident. This will be my last one at the moment, if I have time. And that is, spring came early in March one day, and Pete and I had gone for a hike. Also, we had been down, able to get down off, so we had bought some pansies and stuff, and we put them around to make everything
look
cheerful,
mm-hmm.
like spring.
Mm-hmm.
And we had pumped the water up to the tank. We had running water. We both took our first baths or showers with running water.
Wow.
And we were sitting having breakfast, and all of a sudden, poof, and the water that we had pumped up to our water tank exploded in the pipes. And we said, oh, my gosh, the pipes had frozen. And so we ran down to the lake to where the pump was and had to relieve a big chunk of ice right out of the pipe. It flowed right out of the pipe.
Good heavens.
So we saved the pump, and we saved. And that was the end of having running water until another 3 weeks or 4 weeks before it ever got that warm again.
But that was interesting, because on that very warm day, we had taken a hike to Monument Mountain.
Yes.
Hot. We'd taken our jackets off. We'd taken our shirts off. It was so hot. And we came back to here. The next morning, we woke up to about 6 inches of fresh snow.
Right. That was right the next day. Yeah.
And of course, we had to build a snowman.
All right.
Okay, go on with your story.
Tell your story.
Well,
you didn't call it a snowman.
I just felt that the women needed equal representation, so it turned out to be a snow woman.
All right.
And,
well done.
And we put stones for the nose and mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Two mornings later, all that was left were the stones.
Oh,
the snow was all gone.
All right.
That was just wonderful to watch the change in the scenery, the change in the atmosphere, the stars. I mean,
stars would have been incredible up here.
Stars were and are. And to see the stars and the heavens rotate through the whole season was one of my biggest joys.
Yes.
I just absolutely adored that. And, could walk around at night up here. And I mean, there were just too many things that were joyful.
And what a good experience.
Fabulous experience.
Two things I'd like to add. One thing to that experience, we're always asked how much wildlife did you see?
Mm-hmm.
We didn't see any because there's no food up here for them.
Sure.
Well, we could see.
You could see tracks.
Tracks, but that was it. And the other thing, we mentioned it verbally about the cemetery and being able to recognize so many people buried up there. It's a real sense of community.
It would be. It's a continuation.
A continuation, yes.
Thank you both very much.
You're very
welcome. I'm delighted.